Parents in many parts of the country are experiencing some sticker shock as the new school year begins. And we're not talking about college or private K through 12. We're talking about public schools, where students are now being charged for things that were free 20 or 30 years ago. For example, at Oxford High School in Oxford, Alabama, students pay $15 for a chemistry class. And at high schools in Henrico County, Virginia, students are asked to pay $5 to cover the cost of printer, toner, and paper. And in most cases, schools say budget cuts are the problem and that they're charging fees because they have to. But things are different in California. 3 years ago, Governor Jerry Brown signed a bill forbidding public schools from charging such fees. So what's been the consequence? David Sapp is with the ACLU of California and was one of the lead attorneys in the legal case that prompted the law. David, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So first of all, walk us briefly, if you could, through the story of how California ended up abolishing fees for public schools.
Well, the story actually starts back in 1879 when California adopted its constitution and included a provision that said that students had a right to a free public education. So the public school system was explicitly created as free. And over the years, there have been different guidance, opinions, and decisions, including by the state Supreme Court, that clarified and reinforced what had been written into the constitution in the 1800s. But what we saw back in the early 2010-2011 range was that a lot of schools all of a sudden were very openly charging fees again for basic parts of the education system, for course materials, for basic instruction packs, for we actually saw an enrollment fee. And that's what prompted us to really take action and approach the issue at a statewide level as opposed to just individual instances.
Mm. Now, I presume that schools were doing this, they were charging the fees because they felt that they had to, right? They were trying to make up budget gaps, were they not?
There's absolutely no question that as a whole, as a state, had not invested in the public education system to the extent that many of us believe is necessary to provide the quality of services and richness and robust offerings and programs that students deserve. But we actually like to look at it from the perspective of the student because ultimately schools exist to serve students. And what we saw was that there were students who were being humiliated, who were being excluded from opportunities because of these fees, that they wanted to participate in the programs, but because of the circumstances of their family, they were excluded from the opportunity of pursuing that education or that activity. And that's really fundamentally what this is about. It's the values of what the education system exists for. It was created to be a way to equalize society, to live up the values of America as an egalitarian society that creates and grows the democracy generation to generation. And the problem with creating this fee-based system of public education is that it's creating a two-tier system where those who have the resources are able to pay for more of an opportunity, and those who don't are falling further and further behind. And as we know, as things get more competitive for college and career, that those activities and those educational experiences, taking those extra classes, participating in sports or the arts or band, really do make a difference.
Well, can you describe to me what the impact has been since Governor Brown signed the bill back in 2012? I mean, what has happened at schools? They've stopped charging fees, and so therefore have programs been cut?
What we've seen is that overall the awareness of what the rules are with respect to fees has increased tremendously. What we haven't seen is the wholesale elimination of programs that people believe the school should be offering. There's nothing in the law that prohibits schools from asking parents or any member of the public to contribute their fair share, for example, or to say, if we don't have enough people make a contribution for this cost, we may have to discontinue the program. So again, this goes back to the ultimate value behind the public education system of an investment for an egalitarian society and whatever our community believes it should provide to the young people in the community. Why is it that we're having to charge fees to be able to provide basic instructional materials for science class to students? What does that say about us and how we're valuing the education that we're giving to our kids? So in general, we haven't seen a widespread loss of programming. What we've seen is a more intentional and honest conversation about the resources available to our public schools, because at the end of the day, we know that the state has not invested to the extent that it needs to provide that rich, robust set of offerings that can make an education equal and exciting and engaging for all students.
Okay, but let me ask you, hasn't this not solved the problem at all, but merely repeated it? Because I hear you saying that, okay, in certain cases, schools can fundraise if necessary, or parents can volunteer to make up the gap. In other cases, when that isn't possible, maybe programs do get cut. But in the first instance, don't you end up having a two-tiered system anyway? Because districts with more affluent families will find a way to pay the money, and those without more affluent families will suffer. And then in the second case, if a program ends up getting cut because no fees are allowed to be charged at all, aren't you setting back all students in favor of having protected a few of them from having to pay a fee? I just don't see how the situation now is actually any better than it was before with the fees.
Well, I guess I'll answer the question starting with the second part of the question, which is, what does it look like if we're excluding some students but still able to afford the program? And the first thing is that we haven't actually seen situations where programs are getting cut across the board because a few people aren't able or willing to pay. But more importantly, and I'll just focus on the experience of one of the students that we represent in the case, and she went by a pseudonym. She went by Jane Doe. At the start of the school year, she had her name written on the board because she hadn't been able to pay the $20 or so for a workbook in one of her classes. So what that meant is that every single student and every period of the day for that course throughout the day knew that she was not able to pay. So basically, she was publicly humiliated in front of her classmates. So there's an actual real specific impact on students that I don't think people who sort of make that overall argument are really grappling with.
But if you could, the first part of my previous question about the fact that districts that have more affluent families will find a way to make up the difference, and that further exacerbates the difference between affluent and not so affluent districts. I mean, isn't that still a problem?
Absolutely. It is a problem. And, you know, in California, and this goes back decades, across school district lines, there are differences in the amount that they're able to spend per student. You know, that goes back to the 70s. There was actually a major lawsuit that focused on gross disparities. And even after the court found that the level of disparity was so extreme as to violate the Constitution, even today, we still see that there are those disparities. And so that absolutely is a reality.
And so I'm wondering, short of, you know, the California taxpayers deciding to more fully fund the public education system, is there not an interim way? I mean, you know, we've talked to parents who live in districts where fees are being charged for certain activities, but that exemptions are made for families who can't afford the fees. It's not sort of all or nothing participation.
So the California Supreme Court faced this exact question about, well, what if there's a waiver process? And what the California court decided was that the state constitution here in California doesn't allow such a waiver process. And the court went actually through in pretty detailed analysis of it, of the stigmatizing effect that if you're basically saying a student has to go and affirmatively request it because he or she is not able to pay, that there are significant and real impacts as far as, one, whether students would be willing to do that because of the embarrassment that may attach. And so the effect could be that students aren't actually able to participate, or two, that even if they do, that there is an impact. And again, I'll go back to Jane, who's the student that we represented. That was actually the arrangement. But at one point, she went in to talk to the school principal, and policies are implemented by people, and unfortunately, the reality is that sometimes people, we aren't our best selves all the time, and sometimes we aren't sensitive to what's going on. She went in to talk about it and was asked, well, gosh, what's going on at home? Are you all having problems? And so again, these policies have real-world impacts when they're implemented. And so in California, you know, the policy here is that a waiver does not make an illegal fee somehow legal.
Well, David Sapp is the Director of Education Advocacy for the ACLU of California. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you, Meghna.
Well, we've got fee-paying families weighing in on our Facebook page. Sally Oliver doesn't have a problem with it. She writes, for after-school activities, the PTA should do fundraising. But Heidi Denman McDougall writes from Ohio that if a local levy fails, it's pay-to-play or cut programming. I think it's blackmail, but it's also life. Let us know what you think at facebook.com/hereandnowradio.